Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this May Day and get an analysis of the state of working America from Lawrence Michel, who is the president of the Economic Policy Institute and the principal author of a research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. Then we will speak with labor historian Leon Fink, who edits the journal Labor Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. We will discuss the history of the American labor movement and how it compares to other industrial democracies in terms of political influence and economic clout, as well as get an update on May Day demonstrations held today in Chicago. Then finally, we'll hear about May Day demonstrations in New York from Arun Gupta, who covers the Occupy Wall Street movement for Salon. We will discuss the occupation of Union Square and other demonstrations, and on a day meant to celebrate solidarity with working people around the world, we will look into growing factionalism in the Occupy movement and concerns about co-option. For an update on May Day demonstrations in Los Angeles, Julie Levine joins us, an activist and a leader in the Topanga Peace Alliance and the MLK Coalition for Jobs, Justice and Peace. She is currently a field instructor at the USC School of Social Work. Joining us now is Lawrence Michel, who is president of the Economic Policy Institute. He is the principal author of the research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. His latest report is titled, We're Not Broke, Nor Will We Be. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Michel.
Thanks for having me again.
And across the world, huge demonstrations in Madrid, for example, where 50% of the young working or potential working Spaniards are out of work, over 50%. And all around the world, there seems to be something of a theme, I guess, started by the Occupy movement of class division, the 1% versus the 99%. And I guess the subtext for a lot of this surely has to be what's happened to the middle class as a result of globalization.
Well, I think there's a number of different things going on here. There's a longer-term trend that's been happening for several decades, which has put the squeeze on the middle class in terms of people's the job quality essentially deteriorating, wages not growing as much as you might hope they would or could because of the growth of productivity. And you know, people getting by based on greater debt or having more people in the family working more hours. So that middle class squeeze and rising inequality was going on all through the 1980s and 90s and 2000s. And in fact, the 2000s, even before the recession, was one of the the worst recoveries. The wages for high school graduates and college graduates did not improve at all in the recovery from 2002 to 2007. Well, now on top of that, we have a worldwide recession brought on by deregulation. And, and in Spain, they are suffering from a big housing bubble that burst, and the fact that they've not been able to do policies that really help restore full employment because they're in the EU. They don't have a currency they can depreciate. In the United States, we're had high persistent unemployment, still 8.3%. It's worse than it got in the last two recessions at the worst moments of those recessions. So, you know, we've had many years of way too high unemployment, which only exacerbates problems that was already here. So, yeah, the upper 1% reaped the majority of all the income growth over the pre-recession years. And, now people are really hurting, and we're trying to find our way to get the economy growing, create jobs, and to have people have rising incomes again.
So what would change this economic reality that you alluded to, Lawrence Michel, that's been going on for decades, where household income and productivity used to track in parallel, but now since the 1980s, the only capital has been the beneficiary of increased productivity, and labor is in other words, the lines are converging. The beneficiaries are capital, and they're just going off into outer space, and the losers in the new economy are labor. They're on a steady decline.
Right. Well, I mean, what would I guess there's two things that we need to approach at the same time. One is we need robust job growth, and we need that because people rely on the wage income from their jobs to support themselves. And when unemployment is low is one of the few times that workers have some decent bargaining power to ratchet up their wages and get decent benefits. On top of robust job growth, we need to reconnect the productivity and pay. That is, we've had these several decades where the output of goods and services per hour worked rose a lot. It rose 80% from 1973 to 2011. But the pay of a typical worker grew around 10%. 80% for productivity, 10% for the worker. That's not good.
That's 70%
profit. Those together. 80% overall productivity in the economy.
Sure. That means 70% goes to capital, right?
Well, it goes to other workers,
mm-hmm.
right? Some of that is the difference between what happens to the typical or median worker and the average worker. And so there's a lot of wage income
mm-hmm.
at the very top that's being reaped. Some of it is going to capital. So, you know, we have to reconnect those. How do we do that? Well, full employment. We need to have a much higher minimum wage. We need to have people's right to have a union restored. So unions have to. We need more unions and unions with greater strength. We need decent labor standards. Right now, labor standards in this country aren't even enforced. People don't know what their rights to overtime are. They're not able to enjoy even getting overtime. The people at the very bottom, low-wage workers, have a hard time sometimes even getting paid for the work they do, especially immigrant workers. We have lots of people working at free internships. I mean, that's the labor standards in this country have gone really silent, and we have basically a lawless labor market. So we need to restore that. Part of what we need to do is to make sure we have good health care for everybody and make sure the income growth goes to that. We'll see whether the health care reform under President Obama survives. If not, that'll come back. We have to deal with retirement security. Right now, very few people have a decent pension that they can rely on, and there's threats to try to weaken Social Security, which is the one thing that most people can count on. So, you know, those are some of the things that we need to think about.
Again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Mischel, who is the president of the Economic Policy Institute. He's the principal author of the research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. His latest report is titled, We're Not Broke, Nor Will We Be. But it seems to me that the problem here is the continued financialization of our economy. It used to be that American capitalists produced products, jobs, and created wealth. And now, according to the Federal Reserve, five banks, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, together held $8.5 trillion in assets at the end of 2011, equal to 56% of the U.S. economy compared to 43% in 2006. So these, you know, since they crashed the economy, they're clearly getting wealthier and controlling more of our economy. They seem to be more and more operating, Wall Street seems to be more and more operating on the Mitt Romney model, which is the extraction and concentration model. You extract wealth and concentrate it at the top. And I don't know how long that form of capitalism is sustainable.
Well, I think it is still going on. Corporate profits as a share of the corporate sector, when you divide up the corporate sector income between compensation for workers and profits and other incomes going to capital, the capital share is the largest since during World War II. And during World War II, we had a World Labor Board which consciously suppressed wage growth. So we now have something that works as if we are consciously suppressing wage growth. And I think ultimately that we won't be able to get a robust economy with that kind of maldistribution.
But how is it possible that the economy could change so much, and that the financial services people, the big banks, who almost crashed the global economy, at least took it to a near-death experience, have been made whole, and Main Street languishes, and they're flourishing? Just on the surface, the injustice is breathtaking.
Well, it is rather annoying, and to ask how they do it is less a question of economics and more a question of politics.
So, in other words, they own our politics.
Well, they certainly have a great piece of both parties. Absolutely. I do have faith, though, that ultimately an aware people can, make change, and the way things are not the way they have to be, and it's still possible for the masses of people in the United States to, in fact, make changes that'll make the economy, work for them. I think that's still very possible.
Well, it's possible, Lawrence Michel, again, the president of the Economic Policy Institute. It's possible, but it seems to me in many ways that, there's a great deal of economic illiteracy to begin with, and there is a growing within working America. They seem to be buying the canard from the Republicans that government is the problem, not corporations. And that canard was started by Ronald Reagan, but it seems to have grown in its influence. And frankly, just looking at the power of money since the Supreme Court decision, which of course gave, rather cynically, allowed unlimited money from corporations and labor, but labor is in no way symmetrical. And if you look at what's happening in this country at the state level, it's breathtaking, the control of state legislatures by Republicans, who are essentially putting in corporate lobbyists as their representatives, and all organized through the American Legislative Exchange Council. And, we're almost getting back to the point where we were when the Constitution had to be changed to have elections of senators. I mean, it seems to have gone a full circle.
Well, I think that there is the following circle that I think you're right. I think it was people with money and power who helped change economic policies that allowed the people at the top to reap the huge benefits of the whatever growth we've had over the last three or four decades, and enriching themselves further has given them more resources to, in fact, apply them to politics to maintain and improve upon their own, income and wealth and power. But it's possible. We still live in a democracy, and there's mechanisms by which people together can fight back. It's not hopeless. It's not going to be easy, and one has to have your eyes clear. But they can be overwhelmed, and so we will see how things play out in various struggles. And in Ohio, people rose up, and the law that was passed that got rid of collective bargaining for public workers there was overturned. People have risen up in Wisconsin. They're rising up all over. And I think the Occupy Wall Street has helped change the conversation. And I think, we just don't know what's around the corner. And I think it's a volatile situation, and we're not yet sure. It's hard to know which way it's going to go.
Again, I speak with Lawrence Michel.
It doesn't have to go just for the worse. It can go for the better.
Sure. Well, I don't mean to. I wish we were able to celebrate on May Day the fruits of labor, as opposed to be alarmed by the victories of corporations and the increasing power. And I was just bringing up the example of how corporations have taken over so many state legislatures in a way that I think has missed a lot of people's attention. We're, of course, focused on the federal elections now. But even focusing on that, that's pretty extraordinary, don't you think, that the idea that after what happened in 2008, that we would have a nominee with one of the two major parties being a representative of the 1%. And frankly, Mitt Romney's got a pretty good chance of getting elected.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's annoying that the economic philosophy of free market super Alice that crashed the world economy, then when the economy was doing very poorly and people were upset that it wasn't restored quickly, then elected people with an even more fanatical free market ideology in 2010, who then are going around in various state legislatures and all changing the laws about who can vote, to reinforce their own power. So, this is a very...
It's also incredibly ironic, Lawrence Rochelle, that the 87 Tea Party people that got the freshmen who swept in the 2010 revolution that changed the House and has brought about this paralysis and gridlock, they of course were motivated by their what happened on Wall Street and the government bailout of Wall Street, but now they're all lining up to take money from Wall Street. How quickly it changes. I mean, the representatives now are basically recognizing where the money is and who hands it out, and they're only too willing to take it from the biggest lobby of all, which of course is the financial lobby.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose in a way. The questions that I have here are about whether we'll have a debate about the issues that we've talked about here, Lawrence Rochelle, and that is the nature of American capitalism, how much it's changed from the extraction model, where instead of creating wealth, we're extracting wealth, and the Occupy movement has framed the maldistribution with the 1% versus the 99%. But do you think that there is the Democrats don't seem to defend the narrative that government actually has a role and that we can't throw ourselves all at the mercy of the free market. Do you see any possibility of some real examination? I know there are people like Warren Buffett out there that are quite wealthy who are basically saying, wait a minute, capitalism itself's in crisis.
Well, I think that they're actually, if you read President Obama's speeches, he is trying to build a case for active government that deals with our problems of inequality, deals with social mobility, deals with the need for public investment. And to the degree to which he uses that to frame his policies against other policies which are about basically eliminating government, that we're going to have, I think, the most ideological debates in this presidential election than we've ever had, the clearest choice between different visions. And I'm hoping that the president becomes a strong standard bearer for the need to intervene in the economy to assure that we're going to have a strong middle class.
Well, just in closing, Lawrence Rochelle, do you think that given the economic pain that's out there, is it possible, do you think? I mean, obviously, in many ways, it's easy to demagogue a situation when there is economic pain and the economy's in trouble, and everybody seems to think that the president's re-election fortunes are entirely due to where the economy will be. And there was a great deal of concern about the price of gas. And there again, I think, was a flagrant example of what's wrong with this predatory capitalism, where the price of gas was largely being gained by Wall Street. So is it possible that we can have this debate and not be distracted by the pain? I always recall James Carville's adage from the Clinton years, it's the economy, stupid. Well, you know, if we're going to, if this election is going to be a referendum on the economy, it takes a little more effort and subtlety to recognize who's really sabotaging the economy as opposed to punishing the incumbent.
Right. Well, I think that's right. So if you look at polls, I mean, a lot of people recognize that the economy is bad, and they don't blame it on President Obama. You know, then again, one can imagine holding President Obama accountable for our not having, you know, more progress than we've had. So that's what the election is going to be fought about. You know, what's the state of the economy? Who's responsible? What's the way forward? And I think it's a very healthy debate to have. And I hope there's a clear answer at the end that allows policymakers to actually do something to make things better. Because right now it's just kind of stuck.
So I guess there's some optimism there. Finally, Lawrence Michel, that you think that something in this election, it won't all be just about billions of dollars spent on negative advertising.
Well, I know. I think there actually will be. I there's going to be a lot of attention to who should pay more taxes. There's going to be attention to what role government should have in providing health care to regular people, as well as to the shape of Medicare. Should there be a guaranteed benefit for people in their retirement, or should they just be given a voucher? So that's the Romney plan, is to give a voucher. Obama wants to defend the traditional, you know, we're going to provide you health insurance.
Well,
these are pretty clear debates we're going to have.
Well, Lawrence Michel, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Okay, well, thanks for calling.
Again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Michel, who is the president of the Economic Policy Institute. He is the principal author of a research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. His latest report is titled, We're Not Broke, Nor Will We Be. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to a labor historian in Chicago and get an update on the May Day protests there.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. The strikes of the bosses we must fight.
There once was a union maid. She never was afraid of the goons and the ginks and the company finks and the deputy sheriff that made the raid. She went to the union hall when a meeting it was called. When the company boys come around, she always stood her ground. Oh, you can't scare me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is labor historian Leon Fink, who's a professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where he edits the journal Labor Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. His books include Working Men's Democracy, The Knights of Labor and American Politics, The Mire of Morganton, Work and Community in the Nuevo New South, and his latest, Sweatshops at Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the Present. Welcome to Background Briefing, Leon Fink.
Ian, glad to be with you.
And today, you're in the president's hometown, Chicago. There have been some demonstrations, protesters blocking the Bank of America. It seems that this year on Labor Day, unlike past years where you've had people sort of celebrating labor and marching in solidarity and with some pride, although, you know, there's not a lot to celebrate lately, this time around, it's more of a protest.
I think that there's definitely an ongoing dynamic centered on the relation to Obama and his administration this time around. I do think that the themes of May Day resonate more strongly and more deeply than usual, that the issues of worker solidarity, of basic standards at work, of inequality, and even of class, basic class conflict, are more in the public mind than they've been in perhaps for decades.
Well, of course, there are some serious echoes of history. The marches in Chicago are marching past the scenes of the Haymarket massacre.
Exactly. I think that this is an International Workers' Day that's been more celebrated outside the country than inside, but it has roots in 1886 in the eight-hour movement in Chicago and the subsequent execution of several of the anarchist leaders from that moment. I think that the dynamic with the Obama and the Democrats is a more complicated one, in that the very protest also is a function of the dependence to this moment by the popular movements, nevertheless, on the administration. I mean, they basically have nowhere else to turn, and so it's a kind of slightly adolescent rebellion within the family, I suspect.
Well, it's happening at a time, though, when, you know, you have a one percenter running for president of the United States. It's, you know, it's pretty extraordinary that Mitt Romney, in this climate, was able to get the Republican nomination, and it's even more extraordinary to think that he actually may be the next president of the United States. He has, I think, a very strong chance of winning, and he has...
Exactly. That's why I'm suggesting, Ian, that even though it made a protest, I heard a lot of... I just came in from the streets myself. There's a lot of rhetorical criticism of the president on a variety of issues, from immigration through the detention centers, through the lack of action on labor reform, through the his foreign policy, his muscular militaristic foreign policy. But nevertheless, I think there's a general perception that that the re-election of Obama is perhaps the number one imperative of the of progressives in the United States.
Well, that flies in the face of what they're saying, though. I mean, Mike.
Exactly. That's why I said it was a bit of an adolescent quarrel. That there's no. This is within the family. That there's really no other agency of change, large-scale change, evident in this country right now, other than Obama. That he is upholding as much of a progressive agenda as we're likely to see carried out.
Right, and the problem there is that you have highly motivated Obama haters on the Republican side, and you have demoralized former Obama lovers on the Democratic side.
Yes, that's true. I think that particularly, you know, evident in Chicago is the still resonant immigration rights movement, and they are very frustrated with Obama's lack of movement. They're even willing to entertain Marco Rubio's kind of new proposal for a kind of limbo policy for those, the undocumented, as some grounds for a movement away from the deportations which currently plague the whole community. So I think there's deep frustration in those sectors with the administration's policy, and yet ultimately, what they want is for Obama. They haven't really rejected him. What they want is some sign of, they want some action. They want him to suspend the deportations. Labor, I think, is somewhat heartened, actually, by his recent statements, repelling, the Scott Walker policies, at the state level. So that's what I mean, that there's a kind of call and response from the progressive left to the Obama administration. It's not a rejection because there's no obvious alternative.
Well, in a couple of weeks in Chicago, of course, the NATO summit will begin, and there's an expectation there'll be substantial demonstrations meeting that summit.
Yes, indeed, and I think Mayor Rahm here is doing his best to make the protest as distant and as invisible as possible. There's a high-tech security presence at the same time that's combined with, a rhetorical gesture towards the forces of protest, saying that they're, of course, welcome, too. So I think this is a deft game of manipulating various constituencies that goes on within the Democratic Party umbrella. And I think, again, I don't think that you're going to see a hugely disruptive set of demonstrations in the end, but it's going to be a more protest somewhat suffocated by a combination of tough love and select, probably select coercive containment.
So, Leon Fink, what explains, though, the enormous asymmetry between the power of corporations and the power of labor? And, of course, very cynically, in the recent Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, that has made such a change in the electoral system now, where it was always about money, but now it's about super amounts of money, extraordinary amounts of money. It's really a competition between billionaires over who they can buy. And the Republicans have been incredibly successful, both using this group called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, but more importantly, they have recruited, they've taken over so many legislatures in the country, and they've basically essentially put in corporate lobbyists as candidates. That's, you know, the corporatization of American politics is happening at warp speed, and the Republicans have found a formula to do that, where they just take corporate lobbyists and make them state senators and representatives, and then they're all basically told what to do by ALEC, which is in turn told what to do by the Koch brothers, and you can see an organizational kind of chart there. There just seems to be nothing on the left in terms of a countervailing way to organize people to get into state office. I mean, that the Republicans have really taken over at the state level in a very quick and stealthy way, and I think people just haven't figured it out yet.
Mm-hmm. I do think that the mask is off that operation in a way that it wasn't. I mean, that those efforts do go back some years, and there was very little focus on them, even general awareness of them, and so it has taken... I think it took Occupy, it took Wisconsin to begin to kind of raise the curtain on this kind of underground intellectual, political, business albatross that has grown up. I think Wisconsin is going to be a key moment Walker and some of these or other legislators can be turned out by mass action. That'll give a tremendous shot in the arm to the progressive movement in this country. Otherwise, you're right about the power imbalance. I think that clearly there's been a shift in the center of gravity of American business towards a brazen anti-union, anti-worker agenda, whereas that is partly rooted in the rise of the Sun Belt, the service sector, the Walmart retail capitalists, as opposed to the older industrialist sector, which had made some peace with an element of of moderate trade unionism. So I think that there has been a change, and I think the only good sign that I see is that it's out in the open. I don't think the business, corporate sector, the foundations like Manhattan Institute, et cetera, really like to be so out front in their class rhetoric and ideology. I think they prefer to keep it more subtle. And I think right now, this open, I can't remember a time when there was more open discussion of incomes, class inequality, power, the use of money, the use of corporate power. I mean, this is, in the public sphere is reminds more of the progressive era, with the publicity associated with these issues. And that was, of course, a time also of tremendous inequality, when the J.P. Morgans, the Rockefellers, when they said the only thing Rockefeller hadn't done to the Pennsylvania legislature was refine it. So it's not as if, you know, we haven't faced this imbalance before.
Again, I'm speaking with labor historian Leon Fink, professor of history at the University of Illinois in Chicago, where he edits the journal Labor Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. Of course, the Constitution was amended because the state legislatures were completely controlled by railroad barons, and you just mentioned the Rockefellers controlling the Pennsylvania legislature. That's what's so extraordinary. I mean, they used to basically be appointed, and they were all essentially owned by the powerful interests. And then when the Constitution was amended to have, you know, popular elections of U.S. senators, it obviously was a huge progressive change. But it seems to me that money has gone a full circle now, you know, where...
I think you're right, Ian. I think that the big issue today, which is, I think, being conducted across the airwaves, in the political campaigns, is whether what lesson does the public and do the voters draw from the financial crisis, the financialization crisis, and the collapse of the markets and the banks, 2008 and 2009, the new depression that we're in, really Western worldwide. Do they draw the lesson that this is a problem of predatory banks and corporations, or do they draw the lesson which the right wants to draw, that this is a problem caused by the predatory state? I think that's the issue that we're facing now, and the right would have it that it's the state that stands in the way, so that we need to get rid of the regulations that do exist, the limits that do exist on corporate, on the rights of property. And I think that's the paradox. I do think that this is the first economic crisis, at least since the 1820s or 30s, and the Andrew Jackson period, when there's been a reaction that we should, in the midst of a capitalist crisis, cut back on the regulatory authority of the state. Remember, there was a move to get rid of the Bank of the United States by radical Jacksonians who basically wanted a free market and thought that would help. And I think that, but since that time, most depressions have ended in calls for stronger regulations or stronger state public controls. And that's what the Republicans and their corporate allies are resisting at this point. And I do think that is where the Democrats, Obama at the helm, are making a stand that's both political and discursive, but important, as even if, you know, they're not, it's not as full-throated as many of us would like.
Well, it's certainly not a full-throated defense of government, and we're far from a social democracy, as the Europeans have, with all of the benefits, where people pay their taxes and actually get government services. The only two major government services we get back are Social Security and Medicaid, both of which are for people over 65. And the Republicans are bent on undoing them as well. So you do have a tremendous deficit. A lot of working class Americans buy the Republican line about big government. That's what the Tea Party is all about, and it has a lot of blue-collar people in it. And that's what I find extraordinary, is that so many working Americans are basically shills for big corporations. And, of course, the reality is that what's been happening steadily in the United States is that the federal government has actually become a piggy bank for corporate America, that corporate welfare in the form of the defense weapons industry, the military-industrial complex, agribusiness, oil subsidies. You've noticed that the president can't even get rid of subsidies for oil at a time when the oil companies are making record profits.
Well, that's right, and that's what partly makes a full-throated defense from the left of the state difficult. When you look around at what the current actually existing government does, it does provide a lot of corporate subsidy, a lot of military adventurism, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, you can't, a progressive can't fully embrace the state as we know it either. However, I think some of these distinctions are important to make, and I think that's where there's a difference between the, that's where Occupy and the, even the Tea Party, man in the street, do part ways.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Leon Fink.
Very good. Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Leon Fink, as a Labor historian, a professor of history at the University of Illinois in Chicago, where he edits the journal Labor Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. His books include Working Man's Democracy, The Knights of Labor and American Politics, The Mire of Morganton, Work and Community in the Nuevo New South, and his latest book is Sweatshops at Sea, Merchant Seamen in the World's First Globalized Industry from 1812 to the present. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back going to New York to get an update on what happened in New York today. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Arun Gupta, who is a founding editor of the New York City-based Independent newspaper. He covers the Occupy Wall Street movement for Salon and is writing a book on the decline of the American empire. And also here in Los Angeles, Julie Levine joins us. She's an activist and the leader in the Topanga Peace Alliance and the MLK Coalition for Jobs, Justice, and Peace. She is currently a field instructor at the USC School of Social Work. And I don't know whether I have Arun. Is Arun on? Are you there, Arun? So tell me, Arun, what happened today in New York? I believe there's quite an occupation of Union Square.
Yeah, it was I think conservatively over 10,000 people. It was a great turnout from really a lot of different cross sections of New York. Huge immigrant outpouring, a lot of labor, a lot of people involved in the Occupy movement, all sorts of different community groups from around the city, a lot of students. It had a good militancy to it.
Well, when you speak of militancy, there's been some, I don't imagine you're referring to the kind of militancy that happened today in Seattle and in Oakland and San Francisco.
Well, there hasn't been a lot of police violence here, fortunately. I was at the Wildcat March, which was probably about 500 people. You know, that was the anarchist march, and there was definitely an aggressive police response to that, where they did attack the march, an unpermitted march, when they tried to step off the sidewalk. So at the same time, I think, you know, it was predictable. The protesters, the people who organized this march, should have had something more creative than putting on masks and trying to do an unpermitted march through the streets of New York City. Because, you know, New York just has an absolutely massive police force, 37,000 cops. And their modus operandi is to squelch any sort of democratic outbreak, any sort of radical street politics. But other than that, I haven't seen, you know, anything over the top in terms of too aggressive policing. Though I understand there were some other unpermitted marches where there was some shoving and some other arrests going on. But nothing what we've seen on the scale of the last 6 months in terms of, you know, hundreds of arrests or use of chemical weapons against protesters, or apparently what happened on the West Coast today.
Well, Arun Gupta, you've been writing in Ceylon about your concerns about the possibility of co-option of the Occupy movement. But it would seem what happened today in Seattle with the anarchists breaking windows, what happened in Oakland, similar activities, plus vandalizing a CBS broadcasting van, and then in San Francisco, slashing tires on cars and keying cars. Wouldn't there be more of a concern for the Occupy movement could be co-opted by anarchists who discredit it?
Well, I you know, I think in terms of that whole narrative, you know, we have to remember that this movement really began as an anarchist-inspired and created movement. You know, that it was essentially is kind of radical, decentralized decision-making that comes out of anarchist politics. I think, though, you know, what I saw in New York, I think it's really ineffectual. I can't say, you know, what happened in these other cities, but I'll take your word for it. I don't think it's particularly productive. It's for lack of a better term, it's a certain kind of political acting out. You know, I agree with the perspective that the police are agents of repression, and to think that they're part of the 99% is wishful thinking. You know, so, but at the same time, like, look, if you're going to engage in these type of confrontational street politics, you want thousands and thousands of people on your side.
Sure.
You know,
and you don't want to, I say you don't want to slash the tires and key cars belonging to members of the 99%. I just failed to understand that. Let me introduce Julie Devine here, who's an activist and leader in the Topanga Peace Alliance and the MLK Coalition for Jobs, Justice, and Peace. She's currently a field instructor at the USC School of Social Work. Tell me, Julie, what happened here today in Los Angeles? In terms of May Day protests.
I really should say, Ian, that these days I'm really active in Occupy Los Angeles and Occupy the Hood. MLK, Coalition for Jobs, Justice, and Peace, has become part of Occupy Los Angeles. So we're doing our work there in communities of color, low-income communities around L.A., building local occupations. So I'm here today on May 1st participating in a large general strike, which is a coalition between unions like SEIU, the janitors, et cetera. Many of the unions are out here today. There have been two immigrant rights coalitions marches that we participated in. And as well, we ourselves organized four caravans from one, the West Wind, from West L.A. It actually started in Topanga and then officially began on Ocean and Wilshire. Came into downtown L.A. It's a caravan of cars, bicycles, art cars. There were actions along the way calling attention to wealth inequity, another one organized by our queer affinity group. We had one supporting the veterans who for a long time have been protesting the use of the Veterans Administration land for profit as opposed to for homeless housing for veterans that need it, which is what the donation of the land was supposed to be for. So we've been, you know, we were coming from the West, we were coming from the East, that included groups as diverse as the Brown Berets and, you know, some of the teachers groups, and from the South, which included the Black Writers and all different people from the colleges. Los Angeles Community College joined us. We had another caravan, of course, from the North. We were covered from all directions. We converged in the center, joined up with the first Immigrants' Rights March. Then we had our own convergence on 6th and Main, And then we joined up with the Southern California Immigrants' Rights Coalition, which began marching, is still marching, on Broadway and Olympic, down Broadway at 4 p.m. this afternoon. And it's been huge. I mean, there's helicopters everywhere. I have to say that although there are numbers of police that seem unprecedented and absurd, on bicycles, in riot gear with canisters of tear gas, the whole thing. So far, it's remained relatively peaceful here. So far, knock on wood, that's peaceful on both sides.
So, Jillian,
I do agree with the previous speaker. I believe that, some of us may, particularly white middle-class people, might have come into this movement thinking that somehow police were part of the 99% and they were going to be won over to our cause. But in fact, they are agents of the state. They function that way. And as we've watched, we've all been traumatized as we've been out there exercising our First Amendment rights, nonviolently protesting against the corporate state and, the cutback of all the services we care about, zeroing out of adult education and everything else. The response that we've seen from the police has been generally fairly brutal.
Well, just to touch on one of the demonstrations that happened in Beverly Hills that caught my attention, the Let Them Eat Cupcakes demonstration on the Tony upscale street for the 1% shoppers in Beverly Hills. How did that go down?
I'm still waiting for my cupcake. Actually, I wasn't able to stop because I was in the car caravan. But my understanding is it was highly, highly successful. And that was, as pretty obvious, to call attention to wealth inequality in this country. Two other things I want to share real quick is, of course, that SEIU did close down LAX. They closed the airport down this morning, and that was, I think, fairly significant in terms of, again, showing power of the workers and the power of the 99%. And also, mainstream media is reporting all day that all of today's activities are culminating in a general assembly at 7:30 in Pershing Square. And that's a wonderful thing because it's the first time that they've acknowledged that the occupation movement is still alive and that, in fact, we are facilitating a general assembly tonight at Pershing Square at 7:30, which will be Spanish first and translated into English, and we will do with full collaboration of the union. So we're very, very excited about what's going to happen tonight because if we are successful in building this collaboration with the workers that are out here in these protests today, and they join in our struggle at Occupy and we work together more effectively, I just think the ramifications are huge.
Well, let me go back to New York and speak with Arun Gupta, founding editor of the New York-based independent newspaper. He covers the Occupy Wall Street movement for Salon and is writing a book on the decline of American empire. Do you feel upbeat in the way that Julie here in Los Angeles feels that that it seems that. That they're forming coalitions, and I read your piece in Salon, which is concerned about factionalism. But the whole point of the Occupy movement is it's a big tent, isn't it?
Yeah, I think my partner Michelle Fawson and I have been going across the country for the last month, and have visited a lot of Occupies in the southern half. Tucson, Albuquerque, Tulsa, Little Rock, Atlanta. And there's a lot of great activity going on, but, we also need to be honest. There's a lot of fragmentation. There's some infighting going on. There's also movements in some cities are falling apart. We tried to get in contact with some movements that we had been in contact with in the fall, and we can't get in touch with anyone. Their Facebook pages and websites are inactive, so it appears that they've really just kind of disintegrated. But nonetheless, there is a lot of important activity going on, but at the same point, it's like, look, let's be honest, that the Occupy movement is struggling to regain the prominence it had last fall. And, of course, there are many debates over whether occupations are an end in and of themselves, whether You know, there are new forms of political activity that should be taking place, discussions about an actual organizing going on in communities, trying to build links to existing struggle, to labor unions. But this is also very difficult and hard work. And the reason Occupy had so much leverage last fall, which is why it was actually bringing unions and liberal groups into it, was because of the physical occupation. And that's simply undeniable, that the physical occupations gave the left a power that the kind of the rest of the liberal labor apparatus had to recognize and respond to. So absent the occupations, it then becomes difficult for the left to be able to leverage that power. And what's actually going on then is that the liberal groups and labor unions appear to be using the left's language, the Occupy's language and ideas to support the Democratic Party, which of course is an anathema to the Occupy movement because it is a principled movement. It's not a partisan movement, right? It has certain principles that it's fighting for, and that it sees the Democratic Party as part of this problem. But if it gets shunted into the Democratic Party, then it becomes a partisan project, whereas it's supporting one of the two parties that is in the pocket of Wall Street rather than fighting to end the tyranny of Wall Street. So, you know, there are real obstacles, real problems that are confronting the Occupy movement. I don't think, we should shy away from that. There has to be a healthy discussion and debate about this if it is going to move forward. You know, there is good work being done in the home foreclosure movement and trying to confront the banks and building links to various labor groups, but it's kind of at an inchoate, you know, it's at the beginning stages right now. It doesn't have the quality of a mass movement, and it doesn't have the prominent stage that it did last fall.
Well, just in the last minute, Julie, can you give me a sense of whether we're talking about factionalism here or solidarity in Los Angeles?
I think we're talking about solidarity. I mean, I think that the biggest issue is that the mainstream community of 99%ers thought that the Occupy movement went away. They thought it stopped. I mean, they bought, you know, basically they were giving the information that the corporate media was giving that, you know, either the occupation was, you know, over and it had gone away, or, you know, that it was all controlled by this black box politic and these kind of super anarchistic left-wing people that were just out and bent on destruction. And in reality, at the same time that they were doing that, we were out carefully building. We were building a mortgage foreclosure movement. We were helping people save their homes. We were out building solidarity with immigrant communities and with the homeless on Skid Row and occupying with them on Main and Fifth. I mean, we've been out here working on building relationships and supporting 99% issues long, long time. But leading up to May 1st, I think the solidarity with the unions and particularly the workers in the unions has grown tremendously.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today. Arun Gupta from New York, founding editor of the Independent. He covers the Occupy Wall Street movement for Salon. And in Los Angeles, Julie Levine, who is a leader of the Topanga Peace Alliance, and she's currently a field instructor at the USC School of Social Work. Thank you both very much for joining us. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.